fever from her typhoid shot, still expecting, when she enters the living room in the morning, to see a tree trimmed with lights. But the only thing in the living room is debris. Price tags from all the gifts they've packed for their relatives. Plastic hangers, cardboard from shirts. They shiver as they leave the house. Without coats or gloves, they won't need them where they're going, and it will be August by the time they return. The house has been rented to some American students his father has found through the university, an unmarried couple named Barbara and Steve. In the airport, Goggle stands in the check-in line with his father, who is dressed in a jacket and tie, clothes he still thinks to wear when riding on planes. "Four in the family," his father says when it's their turn, producing 2 U.S. passports and 2 Indian ones. 2 Hindu meals, please." On the plane, Goggle is seated several rows behind his parents and Sonia in another section altogether. His parents are distressed by this, but Goggle is secretly pleased to be on his own. When the stewardess approaches with her cart of beverages, he tries his luck and asks for a Bloody Mary, tasting the metallic bite of alcohol for the first time in his life. They fly first to London and then to Calcutta via Dubai. When they fly over the Alps, his father gets out of his seat to take pictures of the snow-capped peaks through the window. On past trips, it used to thrill Goggle that they were flying over so many countries. Again and again, he would trace their itinerary on the map in the seat pocket below his tray and feel somehow adventurous. But this time it frustrates him that it is to Calcutta that they always go. Apart from visiting relatives, there was nothing to do in Calcutta. He's already been to the planetarium and the zoo gardens and the Victoria Memorial a dozen times. They have never been to Disneyland or the Grand Canyon. Only once, when their connecting flight in London was delayed, did they leave Heathrow and take a double-decker bus tour of the city. On the final leg of the trip, there are only a few non-Indians left on the plane. Bengali conversation fills the cabin. His mother has already exchanged addresses with a family across the aisle. Before landing, she slips into the bathroom and changes, miraculously in that minuscule space, into a fresh sari. A final meal is served, an herbed omelette topped with a slice of grilled tomato. Goggle savors each mouthful, aware that for the next 8 months, nothing will taste quite the same. Through the window, he sees palm trees and banana trees, a damp, drab sky. The wheels touch the ground, the aircraft is sprayed with disinfectant, and then they descend onto the tarmac of Dum Dum Airport, breathing in the sour, stomach-turning early morning air. They stop to wave back at the row of relatives waving madly from the observation deck, little cousins propped up on uncle's shoulders. As usual, the Gangulis are relieved to learn that all their luggage has arrived, together and unmolested, and relieved further still when customs doesn't make a fuss. And then the frosted doors slide open, and once again, they are officially there, no longer in transit, swallowed by hugs and kisses and pinched cheeks and smiles. There are endless names Goggle and Sonia must remember to say, not Aunt This and Uncle That, but terms far more specific, Mashi and Pishi, Mama and Maima, Kaku and Jetu, to signify whether they are related on their mother's or their father's side, by marriage or by blood. Ashima, now Monu, weeps with relief, and Ashok, now Mitu, kisses his brother on both cheeks, holds their heads in his hands. Goggle and Sonia know these people, but they do not feel close to them as their parents do. Within minutes, before their eyes, Ashok and Ashima slip into bolder, less complicated versions of themselves, their voices louder, their smiles wider, revealing a confidence Goggle and Sonia never see on Pemberton Road. "I'm scared, Goggles," Sonia whispers to her brother in English, seeking his hand and refusing to let go. They are ushered into waiting taxis and down VIP Road, past a colossal landfill and into the heart of North Calcutta. Goggle is accustomed to the scenery, yet he still stares at the short, dark men pulling rickshaws and the crumbling buildings side by side with fretwork balconies, hammers and sickles painted on their facades. He stares at the commuters who cling precariously to trams and buses, threatening at any moment to spill onto the street, and at the families who boil rice and shampoo their hair on the sidewalk. At his mother's flat on Amherst Street, where his uncle's family lives now, neighbors look from their windows and roofs as Goggle and his family emerge from the taxi. They stand out in their bright, expensive sneakers, American haircuts, backpacks slung over one shoulder. Once inside, he and Sonia are given cups of Horlicks, plates of syrupy, spongy rosogolas, for which they have no appetite, but which they dutifully eat. They have their feet traced onto pieces of paper, and a servant is sent to Bata to bring back rubber slippers for them to wear indoors. The suitcases are unlocked and unbound, and all the gifts are unearthed, admired, tried on for size. In the days that follow, they adjust once again to sleeping under a mosquito net, bathing by pouring tin cups of water over their heads. In the mornings, Goggle watches his cousins put on their white and blue school uniforms and strap water bottles across their chests. His aunt, Uma Maima, presides in the kitchen all morning, harassing the servants as they squat by the drain, scouring the dirty dishes with ash, or pound heaps of spices on slabs that resemble tombstones. At the Ganguly house in Alipur, he sees the room in which they would have lived had his parents remained in India. The ebony four-poster bed on which they would have slept all together. The armoire in which they would have stored their clothes. Instead of renting an apartment of their own, they spend 8 months with their various relatives, shuttling from home to home. They stay in Baliganj, Tollyganj, Salt Lake, Budgebudg, varied by endless bumpy taxi rides back and forth through the city. Every few weeks, there is a different bed to sleep in, another family to live with, a new schedule to learn. Depending on where they are, they eat sitting on red clay or cement or terrazzo floors, or at marble-top tables too cold to rest their elbows on. Their cousins and aunts and uncles ask them about life in America, about what they eat for breakfast, about their friends at school. They look at the pictures of their house on Pemberton Road.
"Carpets in the bathroom?" they say. "Imagine that."
His father keeps busy with his research, delivering lectures at Jadavpur University. His mother shops in Newmarket and goes to movies and sees her old school friends. For 8 months, she does not set foot in a kitchen. She wanders freely around a city in which Goggle, in spite of his many visits, has no sense of direction. Within 3 months, Sonia has read each of her Laura Ingalls Wilder books a dozen times. Goggle occasionally opens up one of his textbooks, bloated from the heat. Though he's brought his sneakers with him, hoping to keep up with cross-country training, it is impossible on these cracked, congested, chock-a-block streets to run. The one day he tries, Uma Maima, watching from the rooftop, sends a servant to follow him so that Goggle doesn't get lost. It's easier to surrender to confinement. On Amherst Street, Goggle sits at his grandfather's drawing table, poking through a tin full of dried-out nibs. He sketches what he sees through the iron window bars, the crooked skyline, the courtyards, the cobblestone square where he watches maids filling brass urns at the tube well, people passing under the soiled canopies of rickshaws, hurrying home with parcels in the rain. On the roof one day, with its view of Howrah Bridge in the distance, he smokes a bidi tightly rolled in olive-green leaves with one of the servants. Of all the people who surround them at practically all times, Sonia is his only ally, the only person to speak and sit and see as he does. While the rest of the household sleeps, he and Sonia fight over the Walkman, over the melting collection of tapes Goggle recorded back in his room at home. From time to time, they privately admit to excruciating cravings for hamburgers or a slice of pepperoni pizza or a cold glass of milk. They are surprised in the summer to learn that their father has planned a trip for them, first to Delhi to visit an uncle, and then to Agra to see the Taj Mahal. It will be Goggle and Sonia's first journey outside of Calcutta, their first time on an Indian train. They depart from Howrah, that immense, soaring, echoing station where barefoot coolies in red cotton shirts pile the Ganguly Samsonite luggage on their heads, where entire families sleep, covered in rows on the floor. Goggle is aware of the dangers involved. His cousins have told him about the bandits that lurk in Bihar, so that his father wears a special garment under his shirt, with hidden pockets to carry cash, and his mother and Sonia remove their gold jewels. On the platform, they walk from compartment to compartment looking for their four names on the passenger list pasted to the outside wall of the train. they settle onto their blue berths, the top two swinging down from the walls when it is time to sleep and held in place by sliding latches during the day. A conductor gives them their bedding, heavy white cotton sheets and thin woolen blankets. In the morning, they look at the scenery through the tinted window of their air-conditioned car. As a result, the view, no matter how bright the day, is gloomy and gray. They are unaccustomed, after all these months, to being just the four of them. For a few days in Agra, which is as far into Ashima and Ashok as it is to Gogol and Sonia, they are tourists, staying at a hotel with a swimming pool, sipping bottled water, eating in restaurants with forks and spoons, paying by credit card. Ashima and Ashok speak in broken Hindi, and when young boys approach to sell postcards or marble trinkets, Gogol and Sonia are forced to say, "English, please." Gogol notices in certain restaurants that they are the only Indians apart from the serving staff. For 2 days they wander around the marble mausoleum that glows gray and yellow and pink and orange, depending on the light. They admire its perfect symmetry and pose for photographs beneath the minarets from which tourists used to leap to their deaths.
"I want a picture here, just the two of us," Ashima says to Ashok as they wander around the massive plinth.
And so under the blinding Agra sun, overlooking the dried-up Yamuna, Ashok teaches Gogol how to use the Nikon, how to focus and advance the film. A tour guide tells them that after the Taj was completed, each of the builders, 22,000 men, had his thumbs cut off so that the structure could never be built again. That night in the hotel, Sonia wakes up screaming that her own thumbs are missing.
"It's just legend," her parents tell her.
But the idea of it haunts Gogol as well. No other building he's seen has affected him so powerfully. Their second day at the Taj, he attempts to sketch the dome and a portion of the facade, but the building's grace eludes him, and he throws the attempt away. Instead, he immerses himself in the guidebook, studying the history of Mughal architecture, learning the succession of emperors' names, Babur, Humayun, Akbar, Jahangir, Shah Jahan, Aurangzeb. At Agra Fort, he and his family look through the window of the room where Shah Jahan was imprisoned by his own son. At Sikandra, Akbar's tomb, they gaze at gilded frescoes in the entryway, chipped, ransacked, burned, the gems gouged out with penknives, graffiti etched into the stone. At Fatehpur Sikri, Akbar's abandoned sandstone city, they wander among courtyards and cloisters as parrots and hawks fly overhead. And in Salim Chisti's tomb, Ashima ties red threads for good luck to a marble lattice screen. But bad luck trails them on the trip back to Calcutta. At Benares station, Sonia asks her father to buy her a slice of jackfruit, which makes her lips itch unbearably, then swell to three times their size. Somewhere in Bihar, in the middle of the night, a businessman in another compartment is stabbed in his sleep and robbed of 300,000 rupees, and the train stops for 5 hours while the local police investigate. The Gongolese learn the cause of the delay the following morning as breakfast is being served. The passengers agitated and horrified, all speaking of the same thing.
"Wake up! Some guy on the train got murdered," Gogol says to Sonia from his top berth to hers.
No one is more horrified than Ashok, who privately recalls that other train on that other night and that other field where he had been stopped. This time, he'd heard nothing. He'd slept through the whole thing. Upon returning to Calcutta, Gogol and Sonia both get terribly ill. "It is the air, the rice, the wind," their relatives casually remark. "They were not made to survive in a poor country," they say. They have constipation followed by the opposite. Doctors come to the house in the evening with stethoscopes in black leather bags. They are given courses of entraquinol, Ajuan water that burns their throats. And once they've recovered, it's time to go back. The day they were convinced would never come is just 2 weeks away. Kashmiri pencil cups are bought for Ashok to give to his colleagues at the university. Gogol buys Indian comic books to give to his American friends. On the evening of their departure, he watches his parents standing in front of framed pictures of his dead grandparents on the walls, heads bowed, weeping like children. and then the caravan of taxis and ambassadors comes to whisk them one last time across the city. Their flight is at dawn, and so they must leave in darkness, driving through streets so empty they are unrecognizable. A tram with its small single headlight, the only other thing that moves. At the airport, the row of people who had greeted them, have hosted and fed and fawned over them for all these months, those with whom he shares a name, if not his life, assemble once more on the balcony to wave goodbye. Gogol knows that his relatives will stand there until the plane has drifted away, until the flashing lights are no longer visible in the sky. He knows that his mother will sit silently staring at the clouds as they journey back to Boston. But for Gogol, relief quickly replaces any lingering sadness. With relief, he peels back the foil covering his breakfast, extracts the silverware from its sealed plastic packaging, asks the British Airways stewardess for a glass of orange juice. With relief, he puts on his headset to watch The Big Chill and listen to top 40 songs all the way home. Within 24 hours, he and his family are back on Pemberton Road. The late August grass in need of trimming, a quart of milk and some bread left by their tenants in the refrigerator, four grocery bags on the staircase filled with mail. At first, the Gongulis sleep most of the day and are wide awake at night, gorging themselves on toast at 3 in the morning, unpacking the suitcases one by one. Though they are home, they are disconcerted by the space, by the uncompromising silence that surrounds them. They still feel somehow in transit, still disconnected from their lives, bound up in an alternate schedule, an intimacy only the four of them share. But by the end of the week, after his mother's friends come to admire her new gold and saris, after the 8 suitcases have been aired out on the sun deck and put away, after the Chanachur is poured into Tupperware and the smuggled mangoes eaten for breakfast with cereal and tea, it's as if they've never been gone.
"How dark you've become,"
his parents' friends say regretfully to Gogol and Sonia. On this end, there is no effort involved. They retreat to their 3 rooms, to their 3 separate beds, to their thick mattresses and pillows and fitted sheets. After a single trip to the supermarket, the refrigerator and the cupboards fill with familiar labels: Skippy, Hood, Bumblebee, Land O'Lakes. His mother enters the kitchen and prepares their meals once again. His father drives the car and mows the lawn and returns to the university. Gogol and Sonia sleep for as long as they want, watch television, make themselves peanut butter and jelly sandwiches at any time of day. Once again, they are free to quarrel, to tease each other, to shout and holler and say, "Shut up." They take hot showers, speak to each other in English, ride their bicycles around the neighborhood. They call up their American friends, who are happy enough to see them, but ask them nothing about where they've been. And so the 8 months are put behind them, quickly shed, quickly forgotten, like clothes worn for a special occasion, or for a season that has passed, suddenly cumbersome, irrelevant to their lives. In September, Gogol returns to high school to begin his junior year. Honors biology, honors U.S. history, advanced trigonometry, Spanish, honors English. In his English class, he reads Ethan Frome, The Great Gatsby, The Good Earth, The Red Badge of Courage. He takes his turn at the podium and recites the "Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow" speech from Macbeth, the only lines of poetry he will know by heart for the rest of his life. His teacher, Mr. Lawson, is a slight, wiry, shamelessly preppy man with a surprisingly deep voice, reddish-blonde hair, smallish but penetrating green eyes, horn-rimmed glasses. He is the subject of school-wide speculation and slight scandal, having once been married to Miss Sagan, who teaches French. He wears khakis and Shetland sweaters in bright, solid colors, Kelly green and yellow and red, sips black coffee continually from the same chipped blue mug, cannot survive the 50-minute class without excusing himself to go to the teacher's lounge for a cigarette. In spite of his diminutive stature, he has a commanding, captivating presence in the room. His handwriting is famously illegible. Student compositions are regularly returned, stamped with tan rings of coffee, sometimes golden rings of scotch. Every year, he gives everyone either a D or an F on the first assignment, an analysis of Blake's The Tiger. A number of girls in the class, insist that Mr. Lawson is indescribably sexy and have raging crushes on him. Mr. Lawson is the first of Goggle's teachers to know and to care about Goggle, the author. The first day of class, he had looked up from the podium when he came to Goggle's name on the roster, an expression of benign amazement on his face. Unlike other teachers, he did not ask, was that really his name? Was that the last name? Was it short for something else? He did not ask, as many foolishly did, wasn't he a writer? Instead, he called out the name in a perfectly reasonable way, without pause, without doubt, without a suppressed smile, just as he had called out Brian and Erica and Tom. And then, well, we're going to have to read The Overcoat, either that or The Nose. One January morning, the week after Christmas vacation, Goggle sits at his desk by the window and watches a thin, sugary snow fall inconsistently from the sky. We're going to devote this quarter to the short story, Mr. Lawson announces, and instantly Goggle knows. With growing dread and a feeling of slight nausea, he watches as Mr. Lawson distributes the books piled on his desk, giving half a dozen well-worn copies of an anthology, short story classics, to each of the students at the front of the rows. Goggle's copy is particularly battered, the corner blunted, the cover spotted, as if by a whitish mold. He looks at the table of contents, sees Goggle listed after Faulkner before Hemingway. The sight of it printed in capital letters on the crinkly page upsets him viscerally. It's as though the name were a particularly unflattering snapshot of himself that makes him want to say in his defense, "That's not really me." Goggle wants to excuse himself, to raise his hand and take a trip to the lavatory, but at the same time he wants to draw as little attention to himself as possible. And so he sits, avoiding eye contact with any of his classmates, and pages through the book. A number of authors' names have been starred with penciled asterisks by previous readers, but there is no sign or mark by Nikolai Gogol's name. A single story corresponds with each author's name. The one by Gogol is called The Overcoat. But for the rest of the class, Mr. Lawson does not mention Gogol. Instead, to Gogol Ganguly's relief, they take turns reading aloud from The Necklace by Guy de Maupassant. Perhaps, Gogol begins to wonder hopefully, Mr. Lawson has no intention of assigning the Gogol story. Perhaps he's forgotten about it. But as the bell rings and the students rise collectively from their desks, Mr. Lawson holds up a hand. "Read the Gogol for tomorrow," he hollers as they shuffle through the door. The following day, Mr. Lawson writes, "Nikolai Vasilievich Gogol." In capital letters on the board, draws a box around it, then writes the dates of the author's birth and death in parentheses. Gogol opens the binder on his desk, reluctantly copies the information down. He tells himself it isn't so strange. There is, after all, a William in the class, if not an Ernest. Mr. Lawson's left hand guides the chalk rapidly across the board, but Goggle's pen begins to lag. The loose-leaf pages remain blank as those of his classmates fill up with facts on which he will most likely soon be quizzed. Born 1809 in the province of Poltava to a family of Ukrainian Cossack gentry. Father, a small landowner who also wrote plays, died when Gogol was 16. Studied at the Lyceum of Nezhin, went to St. Petersburg in 1828, where he entered, in 1829, the civil service in the Department of Public Works for the Ministry of the Interior. From 1830 to 1831, transferred to the court ministry in the Department of Royal Estates, after which time he became a teacher, lecturing on history at the Young Ladies Institute, and later at the University of St. Petersburg. At the age of 22, established a close friendship with Alexander Pushkin. In 1830, published his first short story. In 1836, a comic play, The Government Inspector, was produced in St. Petersburg. Dismayed by the play's mixed reception, left Russia. For the next 12 years, lived abroad, in Paris, Rome, and elsewhere, composing the first volume of Dead Souls, the novel considered to be his finest work. Mr. Lawson sits on the edge of his desk, crosses his legs, turns a few pages in a yellow legal pad covered with notes. Beside the legal pad is a biography of the author, a thick book called Divided Soul. The page is marked by numerous scraps of torn-up paper. "Not your ordinary guy, Nikolai Gogol," Mr. Lawson says. "He is celebrated today as one of Russia's most brilliant writers. But during his life, he was understood by no one, least of all himself. One might say he typified the phrase eccentric genius. Gogol's life, in a nutshell, was a steady decline into madness. The writer Ivan Turgenev described him as an intelligent, queer, and sickly creature. He was reputed to be a hypochondriac and a deeply paranoid, frustrated man. He was, in addition, by all accounts, morbidly melancholic, given to fits of severe depression. He had trouble making friends. He never married, fathered no children. It's commonly believed he died a virgin. Warmth spreads from the back of Gogol's neck to his cheeks and his ears. Each time the name is uttered, he quietly winces. His parents have never told him any of this. He looks at his classmates, but they seem indifferent, obediently copying down the information as Mr. Lawson continues to speak, looking over one shoulder, his sloppy handwriting filling up the board. He feels angry at Mr. Lawson suddenly. Somehow he feels betrayed. Gogol's literary career spanned a period of about 11 years, after which he was more or less paralyzed by writer's block. The last years of his life were marked by physical deterioration and emotional torment, Mr. Lawson says. Desperate to restore his health and creative inspiration, Gogol sought refuge in a series of spas and sanatoriums. In 1848, he made a pilgrimage to Palestine. Eventually, he returned to Russia. In 1852, in Moscow, disillusioned and convinced of his failure as a writer, he renounced all literary activity and burned the manuscript to the second volume of Dead Souls. He then pronounced a death sentence on himself and proceeded to commit slow suicide by starvation. "Gross," someone says from the back of the classroom. "Why would someone want to do that to himself?" A few people glance at Emily Gardner, rumored to have anorexia. Mr. Lawson, holding up a finger, goes on. In attempts to revive him on the day before his death, doctors immersed him in a bath of broth while ice water was poured over his head and then affixed 7 leeches to his nose. His hands were pinned down so that he could not tear the worms away. The class, all but one, begins to moan in unison, so that Mr. Lawson has to raise his voice considerably in order to be heard. Gogol stares at his desk, seeing nothing. He is convinced that the entire school is listening to Mr. Lawson's lecture, that it's on the PA. He lowers his head over his desk, discreetly presses his hands against his ears. It's not enough to block out Mr. Lawson. By the following evening, he was no longer fully conscious and so wasted that his spine could be felt through his stomach. Gogol shuts his eyes. "Please stop," he wishes he could say to Mr. Lawson. "Please stop," he says, mouthing the words, and then suddenly there is silence. Gogol looks up, sees Mr. Lawson drop his chalk on the blackboard ledge. "I'll be right back," he says, and disappears to have a cigarette. The students, accustomed to this routine, begin talking among themselves. They complain about the story, saying that it's too long. They complain that it was hard to get through. There is talk of the difficulty of Russian names, students confessing merely to skimming them. Gogol says nothing. He has not read the story himself. He has never touched the Gogol book his father gave him on his 14th birthday. And yesterday, after class, he'd shoved the short story anthology deep into his locker, refusing to bring it home. To read the story, he believes, would mean paying tribute to his namesake, accepting it somehow. Still, listening to his classmates complain, he feels perversely responsible, as if his own work were being attacked. Mr. Lawson returns, sitting once more on his desk. Gogol hopes that perhaps the biographical portion of the lecture is over. What else could he possibly have left to say? But Mr. Lawson picks up Divided Soul. "Here is an account of his final moments," he says, and turning toward the end of the book, he reads. "His feet were icy. Tarasenkov slid a hot water bottle into the bed, but it had no effect. He was shivering. Cold sweat covered his emaciated face. Blue circles appeared under his eyes. At midnight, Dr. Klimentov relieved Dr. Tarasenkov. To ease the dying man, he administered a dose of calomel and placed loaves of hot bread around his body. Goggle began to moan again. His mind wandered quietly all night long.
"Go on," he whispered. "Rise up. Charge. Charge the mill."
Then he became still weaker. His face hollowed and darkened. His breathing became imperceptible. He seemed to grow calm. At least, he was no longer suffering. At 8 in the morning of February 21st, 1852, he breathed his last. He was not yet 43 years old. Goggle does not date anyone in high school. He suffers quiet crushes, which he admits to no one, on this girl or that girl, with whom he is already friends. He does not attend dances or parties. He and his group of friends, Colin and Jason and Mark, prefer to listen to records together, to Dylan and Clapton and The Who, and read Nietzsche in their spare time. His parents do not find it strange that their son doesn't date, does not rent a tuxedo for his junior prom. They have never been on a date in their lives, and therefore they see no reason to encourage Goggle, certainly not at his age. Instead, they urge him to join the math team and maintain his A average. His father presses him to pursue engineering, perhaps at MIT. Assured by his grades and his apparent indifference to girls, his parents don't suspect Goggle of being, in his own fumbling way, an American teenager. They don't suspect him, for instance, of smoking pot, which he does from time to time when he and his friends get together to listen to records at one another's homes. They don't suspect him, when he goes to spend the night at a friend's house, of driving to a neighboring town to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show, or into Boston to see bands in Kenmore Square. One Saturday, soon before he is scheduled to take the SAT, his family drives to Connecticut for the weekend, leaving Goggle at home alone overnight for the first time in his life. It never crosses his parents' minds that instead of taking timed practice tests in his room, Goggle will drive with Colin and Jason and Mark to a party. They are invited by Colin's older brother, who is a freshman at the university where Goggle's father teaches. He dresses for the party as he normally does, in Levi's and boat shoes and a checkered flannel shirt. For all the times he's been to the campus to visit his father at the engineering department, or for swimming lessons, or to run laps around the track, he has never been in a dorm before. They approach nervously, a bit giddy, afraid to be caught. "If anyone asks, my brother said to say, we're freshmen at Amherst," Colin advises them in the car. The party occupies an entire hallway, the doors of the individual rooms all open. They enter the first room they can manage to, crowded, dark, hot. No one notices as Goggle and his three friends make their way across the room to the keg. For a while, they stand in a circle, holding their plastic cups of beer, shouting over the music in order to be heard. But then Colin sees his brother in the hallway, and Jason needs to find a bathroom, and Mark needs another beer already. Goggle drifts into the hallway as well. Everyone seems to know everyone else, embroiled in conversations that are impossible to join. Music playing from the different rooms mingles unpleasantly in Goggle's ears. He feels too wholesome in this ripped jeans and t-shirt crowd. Fears his hair was too recently washed and is too neatly combed. And yet it doesn't seem to matter. No one seems to care. At the end of the hallway, he climbs a set of stairs, and at the top there is another hallway, equally crowded and loud. In the corner he sees a couple kissing, pressed up against the wall. Instead of pushing his way through to the other end of the hallway, he decides to climb another set of stairs. This time, the hallway is deserted. An expanse of dark blue carpeting and white wooden doors. The only presence in the space is the sound of muffled music and voices coming from below. He is about to turn back down the staircase when one of the doors opens and a girl emerges. A pretty, slender girl wearing a buttoned-up polka-dotted thrift store dress and scuffed Doc Martens. She has short, dark brown hair curving in toward her cheeks and cut in a high fringe over her brows. Her face is heart-shaped, her lips painted a glamorous red. "Sorry," Goggle says. "Am I not supposed to be up here?" "Well, it's technically a girl's floor," the girl says. "But that's never stopped a guy before." She studies him thoughtfully, as no other girl has looked at him. "You don't go here, do you?" "No," he says, his heart pounding. And then he remembers his surreptitious identity for the evening. "I'm a freshman at Amherst." "That's cool," the girl says, walking toward him. "I'm Kim." "Nice to meet you," He extends his hand and Kim shakes it, a bit longer than necessary. For a moment, she looks at him expectantly, then smiles, revealing two front teeth that are slightly overlapping. "Come on," she says. "I can show you around." They walk together down the staircase. She leads him to a room where she gets herself a beer, and he pours himself another. He stands awkwardly at her side as she pauses to say hello to friends. They work their way to a common area where there is a television, a Coke machine, a shabby sofa, and an assortment of chairs. They sit on the sofa, slouching, a considerable space between them. Kim notices a stray pack of cigarettes on the coffee table and lights one. "Well," she says, turning to look at him, somewhat suspiciously this time.
"What?
Aren't you going to introduce yourself to me?"
"Oh," he says, "yeah." But he doesn't want to tell Kim his name. He doesn't want to endure her reaction, to watch her lovely blue eyes grow wide. He wishes there were another name he could use just this once to get him through the evening. It wouldn't be so terrible. He's lied to her already about being at Amherst. He could introduce himself as Colin or Jason or Mark, as anybody at all. And their conversation could continue, and she would never know or care. There were a million names to choose from. But then he realizes there's no need to lie. Not technically. He remembers the other name that had once been chosen for him, the one that should have been. "I'm Nikhil," he says for the first time in his life. He says it tentatively, his voice sounding strained to his ears, the statement turning without his meaning it to into a question. He looks at Kim, his eyebrows furrowed, prepared for her to challenge him, to correct him, to laugh in his face. He holds his breath. His face tingles, whether from triumph or terror, he isn't sure. But Kim accepts it gladly. "Nikhil," she says, blowing a thin plume of smoke toward the ceiling. Again she turns to him and smiles. "Nikhil," she repeats. "I've never heard that before. That's a lovely name." They sit a while longer, the conversation continuing, goggles stunned at how easy it is. His mind floats. He only half listens as Kim talks about her classes, about the town in Connecticut where she's from. He feels at once guilty and exhilarated, protected as if by an invisible shield. Because he knows he will never see her again, he is brave that evening, kissing her lightly on the mouth as she is talking to him, his leg pressing gently against her leg on the sofa, briefly running a hand through her hair. It is the first time he's kissed anyone, the first time he's felt a girl's face and body and breath so close to his own. "I can't believe you kissed her, Goggle," his friends exclaim as they drive home from the party.
He shakes his head in a daze, as astonished as they are, elation still welling inside him. "It wasn't me," he nearly says. But he doesn't tell them that it hadn't been Goggle who'd kissed Kim, that Goggle had had nothing to do with it. Chapter 5. Plenty of people changed their names. Actors, writers, revolutionaries, transvestites. In history class, Goggle has learned that European immigrants had their names changed at Ellis Island, that slaves renamed themselves once they were emancipated. Though Goggle doesn't know it, even Nikolai Gogol renamed himself, simplifying his surname at the age of 22 from Goggle Yanofsky to Goggle upon publication in the Literary Gazette. He had also published under the name Yanov and once signed his work 0000 in honor of the four O's in his full name. One day in the summer of 1986, in the frantic weeks before moving away from his family, before his freshman year at Yale is about to begin, Goggle Ganguly does the same. He rides a commuter rail into Boston, switching to the Green Line at North Station, getting out at Lechmere. The area is somewhat familiar. He has been to Lechmere countless times with his family to buy new televisions and vacuum cleaners, and he has been to the Museum of Science on field trips from school. But he has never been to this neighborhood on his own, and in spite of the directions he's written on a sheet of paper, he gets briefly lost on his way to the Middlesex Probate and Family Court. He wears a blue Oxford shirt, khakis, a camel-colored corduroy blazer bought for his college interviews that is too warm for the sultry day. Knotted around his neck is his only tie, maroon with the yellow stripes on the diagonal. By now, Goggle is just shy of 6 feet tall, his body slender, his thick brown-black hair slightly in need of a cut. His face is lean, intelligent, suddenly handsome, the bones more prominent, the pale gold skin clean-shaven and clear. He has inherited Ashima's eyes, large, penetrating, with bold, elegant brows, and shares with Ashok the slight bump at the very top of his nose. The courthouse is an imposing old pillared brick building occupying a full city block, but the entrance is off to the side, down a set of steps. Inside, Goggle empties his pockets and steps through a metal detector, as if he were at an airport, about to embark on a journey. He is soothed by the chill of the air conditioning, by the beautifully carved plaster ceiling, by the voices that echo pleasantly in the marbled interior. He had pictured a setting far less grand, and yet this is a place, he gathers, that people come to seek divorces, dispute wills. A man at the information booth tells him to wait upstairs, in an area filled with round tables, where people sit eating their lunch. Goggle sits impatiently, one long leg jiggling up and down. He has forgotten to bring a book to read, and so he picks up a discarded section of the Globe, skimming an article in the arts section about Andrew Wyeth's Helga paintings. Eventually, he begins to practice his new signature in the margins of the paper. He tries it in various styles, his hand unaccustomed to the angles of the N and the dotting of the two I's. He wonders how many times he has written his old name, at the tops of how many tests and quizzes, how many homework assignments, how many yearbook inscriptions to friends. How many times does a person write his name in a lifetime? 1 million? 2 million? The idea to change his name had first occurred to him a few months ago. He was sitting in the waiting room of his dentist, flipping through an issue of Reader's Digest. He'd been turning the pages at random until he came to an article that caused him to stop. The article was called Second Baptisms. Can you identify the following famous people? Was written beneath the headline. A list of names followed, and at the bottom of the page, printed in tiny letters upside down, the famous personalities they corresponded to. The only one he guessed correctly was Robert Zimmerman, Bob Dylan's real name. He had no idea that Molière had been born Jean-Baptiste Poquelin, and that Leon Trotsky was born Lev Davidovich Bronstein, that Gerald Ford's name was Leslie Lynch King Jr., and that Engelbert Humperdinck's was Arnold George Dorsey. They had all renamed themselves, the article said, adding that it was a right belonging to every American citizen. He read that tens of thousands of Americans had their names changed each year. All it took was a legal petition, the article had said, and suddenly he envisioned Goggle, added to the list of names, Nickel, printed in tiny letters upside down. That night at the dinner table, he brought it up with his parents. It was one thing for Goggle to be the name penned in calligraphy on his high school diploma and printed below his picture in the yearbook he'd begun. It was one thing even for it to be typed on his applications to 5 Ivy League colleges, as well as to Stanford and Berkeley. But engraved 4 years from now on a Bachelor of Arts degree? Written at the top of a resume? Centered on a business card? It would be the name his parents picked out for him, he assured them, the good name they'd chosen for him when he was 5. What's done is done, his father had said. It will be a hassle. Goggle has, in effect, become your good name. It's too complicated now, his mother said, agreeing. You're too old. I'm not, he persisted. I don't get it. Why did you have to give me a pet name in the first place? What's the point? It's our way, Goggle, his mother maintained. It's what Bengalis do. But it's not even a Bengali name. He told his parents what he'd learned in Mr. Lawson's class about Goggle's lifelong unhappiness, his mental instability, about how he'd starved himself to death. Did you know all this stuff about him? He asked. You forgot to mention that he was also a genius, his father said. I don't get it. How could you guys name me after someone so strange? No one takes me seriously, Goggle said. Who? Who does not take you seriously? His father wanted to know, lifting his fingers from his plate, looking up at him. People, he said, lying to his parents. For his father had a point. The only person who didn't take Goggle seriously, the only person who tormented him, the only person chronically aware of and afflicted by the embarrassment of his name, the only person who constantly questioned it and wished it were otherwise, was Goggle. And yet, he continued, saying that they should be glad that his official name would be Bengali, not Russian. "I don't know, Goggle," his mother had said, shaking her head. "I really don't know." She got up to clear the dishes. Sonia slinked away up to her room. Goggle remained at the table with his father. They sat there together, listening to his mother scraping the plates, the water running in the sink. "Then change it," his father said simply, quietly, after a while. "Really?" "In America, anything is possible. Do as you wish." And so he had obtained a Commonwealth of Massachusetts change of name form to submit along with a certified copy of his birth certificate and a check to the Middlesex Probate and Family Court. He'd brought the form to his father, who had glanced at it only briefly before signing his consent, with the same resignation with which he signed a check or a credit card receipt, his eyebrows slightly raised over his glasses, inwardly calculating the loss. He'd filled out the rest of the form in his room late at night when his family was asleep. The application consisted of a single side of a cream-colored sheet, and yet it had taken him longer to fill out than his applications for college. On the first line, he filled out the name he wished to change, and his place and date of birth. He wrote in the new name he wished to adopt, then signed the form with his old signature. Only one part of the form had given him pause. In approximately three lines, he was asked to provide a reason for seeking the change. For nearly an hour, he'd sat there, wondering what to write. He'd left it blank in the end. At the appointed time, his case is called. He enters a room and sits on an empty wooden bench at the back. The judge, a middle-aged, heavy-set black woman wearing half-moon glasses, sits opposite on a dais. The clerk, a thin young woman with bobbed hair, asks for his application, reviewing it before handing it to the judge. There is nothing decorating the room apart from the Massachusetts state and American flags and an oil portrait of a judge. "Goggle Gangly," the clerk says, motioning for Goggle to approach the dais. And as eager as he is to go through with it, he is aware, with a twinge of sadness, that this is the last time in his life he will hear that name uttered in an official context. In spite of his parents' sanction, he feels that he is overstepping them, correcting a mistake they've made. "What is the reason you wish to change your name, Mr. Ganguly?" the judge asks. The question catches him off guard, and for several seconds he has no idea what to say. "Personal reasons?" he says eventually. The judge looks at him, leaning forward, her chin cupped in her hand. "Would you care to be more specific?" At first he says nothing, unprepared to give any further explanation. He wonders whether to tell the judge the whole convoluted story about his great-grandmother's letter that never made it to Cambridge, and about pet names and good names, about what had happened on the first day of kindergarten. But instead, he takes a deep breath and tells the people in the courtroom what he has never dared to admit to his parents. "I hate the name Goggle," he says. "I've always hated it." "Very well," the judge says, stamping and signing the form, then returning it to the clerk. He is told that notice of the new name must be given to all other agencies, that it's his responsibility to notify the Registry of Motor Vehicles, banks, schools. He orders three certified copies of the name change decree, two for himself and one for his parents to keep in their safe deposit box. No one accompanies him on this legal rite of passage, and when he steps out of the room, no one is waiting to commemorate the moment with flowers and Polaroid snapshots and balloons. In fact, the procedure is entirely unmomentous, and when he looks at his watch, he sees that from the time he had entered the courtroom, it had taken all of 10 minutes. He emerges into the muggy afternoon, perspiring, still partly convinced it is a dream. He takes the tea across the river to Boston. He walks with his blazer clasped by a finger over his shoulder, across the common, through the public garden, over the bridges, and along the curving paths that rim the lagoon. Thick clouds conceal the sky, which appears only here and there like the small lakes on a map, and the air threatens rain. He wonders if this is how it feels for an obese person to become thin, for a prisoner to walk free. "I'm Nikhil," he wants to tell the people who are walking their dogs, pushing children in their strollers, throwing bread to the ducks. He wanders up Newbury Street as drops begin to fall. He dashes into Newbury Comics, buys himself London Calling and Talking Heads 77 with his birthday money, a Che poster for his dorm room. He pockets an application for a student American Express card, grateful that his first credit card will not say goggle in raised letters at the bottom. "I'm Nikhil," he is tempted to tell the attractive nose ring cashier with dyed black hair and skin as pale as paper. The cashier hands him his change and looks past him to the next customer, but it doesn't matter. Instead, he thinks of how many more women he can now approach, for the rest of his life, with this same unobjectionable, uninteresting fact. Still, for the next 3 weeks, even though his new driver's license says Nikhil, even though he sliced up the old one with his mother's sewing scissors, even though he's ripped out the pages in front of his favorite books in which he'd written his name until now, there's a snag. Everyone he knows in the world still calls him Goggle. He is aware that his parents and their friends and the children of their friends and all his own friends from high school will never call him anything but Goggle. He will remain Goggle during holidays and in summer. Goggle will revisit him on each of his birthdays. Everyone who comes to his going away to college party writes, "Good luck, Goggle," on the cards. It isn't until his first day in New Haven, after his father and teary mother and Sonia are headed back up 95 toward Boston, that he begins to introduce himself as Nikhil. The first people to call him by his new name are his suite mates, Brandon and Jonathan, both of whom had been notified by mail over the summer that his name is Goggle. Brandon, lanky and blonde, grew up in Massachusetts not far from Goggle and went to Andover. Jonathan, who is Korean and plays the cello, comes from L.A. "Is Goggle your first name or your last?" Brandon wants to know. Normally that question agitates him, but today he has a new answer. "Actually, that's my middle name," Goggle says by way of explanation, sitting with them in the common room to their suite. "Nikhil is my first name. It got left out for some reason." Jonathan nods in acceptance, distracted by the task of setting up his stereo components. Brandon nods too. "Hey, Nikhil," Brandon says a while later, after they have arranged the furniture in the common room to their liking. "Want to smoke a bowl?" Since everything else is suddenly so new, going by a new name doesn't feel so terribly strange to Goggle. He lives in a new state, has a new telephone number. He eats his meals off a tray in Commons, shares a bathroom with a floor full of people, showers each morning in a stall. He sleeps in a new bed, which his mother had insisted on making before she left. He spends the days of orientation rushing around campus, back and forth along the intersecting flagstone path, past the clock tower and the turreted, crenellated buildings. He is too harried at first to sit on the grass in old campus as the other students do, perusing their course catalogs, playing frisbee, getting to know one another among the verdigris-covered statues of robed, seated men. He makes a list of all the places he has to go, circling the buildings on his campus map. When he is alone in his room, he types out a written request on his Smith Corona, notifying the registrar's office of his name change, providing examples of his former and current signatures side by side. He gives these documents to a secretary along with a copy of the change of name form. He tells his freshman counselor about his name change. He tells the person in charge of processing his student ID and his library card. He corrects the error in stealth, not bothering to explain to Jonathan and Brandon what he's so busy doing all day. And then suddenly, it is over. After so much work, it is no work at all. By the time the upperclassmen arrive and classes begin, he's paved the way for a whole university to call him Nikhil. Students and professors and TAs and girls at parties. Nikhil registers for his first four classes. Intro to the History of Art, Medieval History, a semester of Spanish, Astronomy to fulfill his hard science requirement. At the last minute, he registers for a drawing class in the evenings. He doesn't tell his parents about the drawing class, something they would consider frivolous at this stage of his life, in spite of the fact that his own grandfather was an artist. They are already distressed that he hasn't settled on a major and a profession. Like the rest of their Bengali friends, his parents expect him to be, if not an engineer, then a doctor, a lawyer, an economist at the very least. These were the fields that brought them to America, his father repeatedly reminds him. The professions that have earned them security and respect. But now that he's Nikhil, it's easier to ignore his parents, to tune out their concerns and pleas. With relief, he types his name at the tops of his freshman papers. He reads the telephone messages his suite mates leave for Nikhil on assorted scraps in their rooms. He opens up a checking account, writes his new name into course books. Me llamo Nikhil, he says in his Spanish class. It is as Nikhil that first semester that he grows a goatee, starts smoking Camel Lights at parties and while writing papers and before exams, discovers Brian Eno and Elvis Costello and Charlie Parker. It is as Nikhil that he takes Metro North into Manhattan one weekend with Jonathan and gets himself a fake ID that allows him to be served liquor in New Haven bars. It is as Nikhil that he loses his virginity at a party at Ezra Stiles, with a girl wearing a plaid woolen skirt and combat boots and mustard tights. By the time he wakes up, hungover, at 3 a.m, she has vanished from the room, and he is unable to recall her name. There is only one complication. He doesn't feel like Nikhil. Not yet. Part of the problem is that the people who now know him as Nikhil have no idea that he used to be Goggle. They know him only in the present, not at all in the past. But after 18 years of Goggle, 2 months of Nikhil feel scant, inconsequential. At times he feels as if he's cast himself in a play, acting the part of twins, indistinguishable to the naked eye, yet fundamentally different. At times, he still feels his old name, painfully and without warning, the way his front tooth had unbearably throbbed in recent weeks after a filling, threatening for an instant to sever from his gums when he drank coffee or iced water, and once when he was riding in an elevator. He fears being discovered, having the whole charade somehow unravel, and in nightmares his files are exposed, his original name printed on the front page of the Yale Daily News. Once, he signs his old name by mistake on a credit card slip at the college bookstore. Occasionally, he has to hear Nikhil 3 times before he answers. Even more startling is when those who normally call him Goggle refer to him as Nikhil. For example, when his parents call on Saturday mornings, if Brandon or Jonathan happens to pick up the phone, they ask if Nikhil is there. Though he has asked his parents to do precisely this, the fact of it troubles him, making him feel in that instant that he is not related to them, not their child. "Please come to our home with Nikhil one weekend," Ashima says to his roommates when she and Ashok visit campus during parents' weekend in October. The suite hastily cleared of liquor bottles and ashtrays and Brandon's bong for the occasion. The substitution sounds wrong to Goggle. Correct, but off-key, the way it sounds when his parents speak English to him instead of Bengali. Stranger still is when one of his parents addresses him in front of his new friends as Nikhil directly. "Nikhil, show us the buildings where you have your classes," his father suggests. Later that evening, out to dinner with Jonathan at a restaurant on Chapel Street, Ashima slips, asking, "Goggle, have you decided yet what your major will be?" Though Jonathan, listening to something his father is saying, doesn't hear, Goggle feels helpless, annoyed yet unable to blame his mother, caught in the mess he's made. During his first semester, obediently but unwillingly, he goes home every other weekend after his last Friday class. He rides Amtrak to Boston and then switches to a commuter rail, his duffel bag stuffed with course books and dirty laundry. Somewhere along the 2.5-hour journey, Nikhil evaporates and Goggle claims him again. His father comes to the station to fetch him, always calling ahead to check whether the train is on time. Together they drive through the town, along the familiar tree-lined roads, his father asking after his studies. Between Friday night and Sunday afternoon, the laundry, thanks to his mother, gets done, but the course books are neglected. In spite of his intentions, Goggle finds himself capable of doing little at his parents' but eat and sleep. The desk in his room feels too small. He is distracted by the telephone ringing, by his parents and Sonia talking and moving through the house. He misses Sterling Library, where he studies every night after dinner, and the nocturnal schedule of which he is now a part. He misses being in his suite in Farnham, smoking one of Brandon's cigarettes, listening to music with Jonathan, learning how to tell the classical composers apart. At home, he watches MTV with Sonia as she doctors her jeans, cutting inches off the bottoms and inserting zippers at the newly narrowed ankles. One weekend, the washing machine is occupied because Sonia is in the process of dyeing the vast majority of her clothing black. She is in high school now, taking Mr. Lawson's English class, going to the dances Goggle never went to himself, already going to parties at which both boys and girls are present.